This is 91.7 WVXU, Cincinnati Edition. I'm Dan Hurley.
The people have elected me to a four-year term, and I intend to serve that four-year term. And councils have been elected, and I believe that we deserve to have a government that has the confidence of the elected officials. He is not entitled to serve as city manager, but obviously I can't remove him without council's approval.
I think the mayor is like a two-year-old throwing a tantrum when he doesn't get his way. That's what's going on here. For whatever the reasons are, he's very upset with the manager because he followed the recommendation of Chief Isaac to separate Bailey from city service.
Reporters love a week like the one we just had in Cincinnati. Long simmering issues at City Hall and the Board of Education came to a head. Well-known public figures with strong personalities, the mayor, the city manager, the CEO of the upstart soccer franchise, who is backed by some of the richest people in the city, fought it out on the airwaves and on the front pages of the newspapers. Oh, by the way, lots of other things happened too. I'm joined today by the journalists who covered these events and tried to put them into context. Anjanette Levy was a longtime colleague of mine at Local 12. Chris Wetterich is a staff reporter and columnist for Cincinnati Business Courier. James Pilcher is an investigative reporter with the Cincinnati Enquirer. And you can join the conversation by calling 513-419-7100 or emailing us at talk@wvxu.org. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. Welcome, everybody. This is, as I said, an interesting week.
Nice to be here, Dan.
Let's start with the situation at City Hall. There have been things developing over at City Hall. Today, the mayor was going to try to see if he could get a new piece of legislation to protect whistleblowers. Chris, I think you were there.
I was, and Dan, it's important that you listeners couldn't hear you put that in air quotes, but I think the air quotes are important when you talk about whistleblowers. There's already state and municipal protection against whistleblowers. This ordinance today did not get called for a vote because the or at least the people who are not yet willing to fire or strike a severance deal with Harry Black, the city manager, they did not show up, and so council did not have a quorum. The news of the day, though, was that Councilman David Mann put out a statement, and it had two important things in it. One was that he said that Harry Black actually would like to leave city service, and that the second thing is that he would accept 18 months worth of his salary as a severance. We talked with Harry after the meeting. He didn't confirm either of those two assertions, and so kind of that's where we are. There are some members of council that I think hope a severance deal can be worked out in the next 4 or 5 days, and they can find 5 needed votes for that. But that's kind of where we are this afternoon.
The other two here, what's your observations about where we stand, and you know, how do we get past this sort of deadlock?
This is the closest the city can have to having a constitutional crisis. It really, really is. I actually was working, talking to colleagues in the office this morning who are poring through the charter. Through the city's charter to figure out what exactly can or will be done in a situation like this. And there's no provision for something other than a council vote to get rid of a city manager who is essentially the CEO of the city. But because of this quasi strong mayor situation that we have, you know, he gets some say in the governing of the city too, which is unlike other cities. So there's not like they can't go into executive session. That's against the city charter to kind of hash it out in private. Everything has to be done out in the open. There's no removal process for someone like this in a situation like this. So basically, you know, the mayor has to plead his case publicly to city council and hope he gets 5 votes, which he doesn't have, to either fire him or to agree to $500,000. Now, the argument becomes, okay, is $500,000 now worth the price of all of the aggravation and the gridlock that will happen for the next however long? Or are the politicians on city council worried about that blowing back on them too? So, I mean, and looking back on this, this goes back a couple years back to when Cranley was given raises over Black's objections to the fire in the police department.
Well,
so
I
this
think
is
that's,
the start. That started all of this.
I think that's really the break point between the two of them.
Right.
Because the mayor stepped in and interrupted the normal process. I mean, the question I can't get past, Anjanette, is if they continued down the two paths that they're on now, and this is sort of what James is saying too, I can't imagine how you go forward with the that situation where you have somebody who's trying to drive somebody out and their offices are literally, I don't know, 15 feet
right
across a common space from
and
each other?
I don't understand how you know, literally you're having battle lines drawn down the middle of City Hall, and it's you're either on this side or you're on the other. And that's not fair to the residents in the city. It's not fair to the employees. It's not fair to council members. And the way it's been going, I mean, if we're kicking off the smear campaign yesterday with a visit to a strip club and, you know—
2 years ago, by the way.
Right,
it was the first we heard about it.
Yeah, 2 years ago. And, you know, you got a slap on the wrist for it. It was okay back then. And you were told, don't do that again, and got a raise afterwards. And now it's a big deal just because you want him gone. I mean, what else is going to come out? It's just going to be a constant mudslinging. And I don't think that it's not workable. And I don't know whether Harry Black should leave or not. It's not my job to decide that. But if, you know, the last two or three nights I've gone to press conferences, the first with the Sentinels, the next night last night with the NAACP, the Urban League, the Black Agenda, a variety of African-American groups who are saying – they want to put a mechanism in the charter to recall the mayor, potentially, because they're so upset about this. I don't think it's workable. I don't think that you can function as a city going forward if we're going to keep on going the way this is going. And, it, and it's, frankly, quite juvenile and childish.
And Cranley, quite let's just face facts, Cranley's not going anywhere.
No.
The only person who could or will leave is Black if he does.
That's right.
Because, I mean, Cranley was elected, and like Annette said, there's no way to get rid of him other than a recall. And that's incredibly difficult.
Well, I think
keep in mind on the recall thing, it doesn't exist in the charter. They would have to run two different elections. One, to put it in the charter, they would have to win that election. And then the second, they would have to go and recall him. I think that's probably a two-year process at least. By the time that they finished with it, he'll almost be done with his term.
Well, the other part of this is this could be used as the springboard to argue for an executive mayor. Mm-hmm. The only problem is that the very reason that you might want to argue about it is something that's going to be looked upon as, oh, the mayor's created a lot of this. Therefore, why would we give him more power? I just –
And any change would probably not be effective until the next mayor anyway. It's not going to affect this mayor. You know, and I think that I really question that idea that we should change our constitution, the city's constitution, because we have these two dysfunctional individuals in place. I mean, we're not talking about changing our federal constitution given our current president. So I'm not sure why we would do it in the city.
The only thing I would say there is, and this picks up on something James said, that under the current form of the charter, we have a stronger mayor. My argument is always we have a direct elected mayor. Mm-hmm. We do not have a strong mayor. The additional powers the mayor got in this last reform came out of the hide of council, not out of the manager's office.
Right.
The manager didn't lose any power at all.
Right.
So we got to be careful here. And I think people want to believe when they're in that office of mayor that somehow they've got more power than they really do under the charter.
If I could speak to that for a second, I think that and John Cranley has chafed at those restrictions. You know, the mayor is the chief policymaker of the city. He is more powerful than council. He has control over council, but he really does not have control over the city's bureaucracy. And that is what has happened here. The city manager at this point has disagreed with how or taken certain actions in administrating the city that the mayor has disagreed with. And that is what he will deny this up and down, but that is what has sparked this crisis.
And it's also been and John Cranley is a political animal. Right. So and this all has been grounded in politics as well. Chris off the air earlier was making the observation, and that I'm going to make on the air as well, that Cranley owes a lot of what he has now to the police and fire unions.
Right.
And he paid them back for that. But in so doing, he undermined the administration. And I know people in the administration were telling me as part of these negotiations, they were going to not only negotiate salaries and all of that, they were going to negotiate tougher discipline forms. This all comes as the collaborative agreement is being refreshed. And you have an African-American community looking at this. And then all of a sudden, Harry Black fires a popular white cop. And then he's under the fire for it. It gets into all of those racial politics. It gets into all those union politics. It gets into all of that. And Cranley clearly has his base, has chosen his base.
Well, one of the questions, Anjanette, you raised the point that it's almost childish what is going on. Who are the adults in the room over there at City Hall?
I think David Mann is the adult in the room. And the other members of council, as a reporter, I can't stand it when people don't call me back or comment, or they call me back and say they can't comment. But that's what's been happening this week. It seemed to me, just from watching this morning, Jeff Pastor was trying to be an adult in the room. And Amy Murray seemed the same. But it's untenable. The situation is getting to be beyond ridiculous. I'm not going to tell you that I haven't enjoyed the last couple of days covering it as a reporter. But when you step back and look at it, it's somewhat ridiculous.
But to be honest, let's go back in history a little bit and this particular makeup of council in Cranley. Some of this is Cranley's own doing. He could have early on created better relationships with Sittenfeld and
Seelbach
and even Yvette early on, and he didn't. And he is also, as much as Harry Black is an abrasive personality, John Cranley can be an abrasive personality. And like Wendell said, he can throw his own little temper tantrums, and he has alienated half of council. Now he has to deal with that. This is the roosters coming. This is the chickens coming home to roost on him a little bit.
Well, and I think that's if they get into running a lot of people in front of the mic to say things about the manager. The manager will have the right to run people through the mic who will say things about John. And mm-hmm. John has a temper. We all know it.
Right.
And the way he's treated people. Yesterday on this show, he wanted to make the point that what he was really doing here was protecting city employees from an abusive manager. Well, you know, that can go both ways. And once you get into that, it's sort of it's a dead end, I think.
I'm not sure I buy that. I think this is creating a show. It's almost an intimidation tactic, I think.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, Harry, you're not going to take the severance package. You want to stay. Well, let's do this now.
Yep. The more I think about this, though, you know, the five members of council who are either standing by. And we need to parse this a little bit, because Chris Seelbach has no love lost for Harry Black.
Right.
Let's keep that in mind. There are five members of council, though, who are not willing to sign off on firing him or doing a severance. And I think the reason is they are, you know, they for whatever reason, have their issues with Cranley and are not willing to buckle to him, basically, on this issue. The more I think about it, though, if they let it go, if they sign off on this thing with Black, if Black really wants to leave and would sign this thing, they will have the power to deal with John in terms of the next city manager. And they will have the power, I think, if they stick together to, you know, I don't know if dictate is the right word, but really influence heavily who he chooses as the next city manager and ensure that that person is independent of the mayor's office in a way that maybe Harry early on in his tenure was not.
Well, we're going to have to take a break. I just want to remind everybody that Harry Black was the choice of John Cranley.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is where this all gets started, and there's a certain irony there. One of the things that I wanted to pick up and to move on, still with city affairs, is, James, you published an article last Sunday on the question of the debt load of the city of Cincinnati,
mm-hmm.
and whether that is getting to a level that poses some serious questions. You want to just give us a quick summary of that?
Absolutely. And let me first explain a little bit of the genesis behind why I did that. When Mayor Cranley first took over last time, I decided to take a look at the balance sheet of the city just to kind of – he's coming in. What is he facing? Whatever. And obviously at that point, the biggest obstacle financially for the city on the table was the pension, the ailing pension plan. So I was looking at how much does the city owe, whatever. And it was substantial back then. And even back then, we proved that when you adjust for inflation, the amount of the debt the city was carrying had tripled in a quarter century. So with all of the talk recently of the city maybe borrowing for more stuff, whether it be the Western Hills Viaduct to pay their portion of the local share, mm-hmm. or these new buildings for the police and fire departments, or maybe even borrowing to help with the infrastructure around a new soccer stadium for FC Cincinnati. I said, well, the time is right to relook at this. And what I found was that, yes, it's still historically, it's still going up. But more, you know, so it's still triple what it was 25 years ago, just for how much they pay to pay basically pay off their credit card. They pay more than $50 million in interest alone. They're paying $125 million a year. Out of not all of it comes out of general funds, so it's not straight out of your tax dollars, but it's still $125 million alone. It costs $130 million to run the police department. So they're paying almost as much to pay off debt as they are to run the police department. They're paying more in interest than it takes to run the city's share of the budget. I'm sorry, not the city's share, but the full budget of the health department. So, you know, there's going to have to be some choices made down the road. They still have room underneath the cap, the state imposed cap, and they have some room under their own lower imposed cap to borrow if they need to. And in their defense, they're getting a very good interest rate. They have a very good credit rating. But if you look deep in that credit rating, they're not thought of as having – their debt risk is pretty high.
Yeah. They S&P, as you, in your article, you said yes. The S&P did raise – their level.
Yeah, that was pretty much done. I talked to the S&P analysts and the city kind of disputed me on this, but I got it straight from the horse's mouth from S&P. And what they said was that was primarily done for two reasons. One, they fixed the pension system, but they had to borrow money to do so. So they borrowed $35 million to plug into the pension system. And two, the economy improved. And tax dollars were flowing in better. So that was a big reason. Those are the two biggest reasons why.
Of course, the other side of that is you take a lot of other governments, both local mm-hmm. and state. Look at Kentucky.
Right.
Where the pension – trying to solve the pension problem
right.
is even more drastic.
And no one is saying that Cincinnati is close to being the next Detroit or Illinois or Chicago, which, you know, Detroit already went through mm-hmm. Bankruptcy and they're just being threatened in Illinois and in Chicago because of their pension systems. But at one point it was. And this was just kind of a gauge of, you know, in one study, if you include the pension debt, one study had it at $14,000 in debt for every taxpayer in the city. I mean, it's up to people whether they're willing to live with that and what you're getting for your investment, right? So it's just – but this was just to lay it out there. You know, not a lot of people look at city finances, but sort of laying it out there, where does your money go?
One of the other things, though, you noted here was that a significant portion, 60%, I think, of the debt is in 10-year bonds.
Yes.
Whereas most municipal bonds
right. –
are 20 to 30-year bonds.
Yes.
Therefore, Cincinnati is turning those over quicker
yes.
and saving money. It's like having a 15-year loan on your house rather
right.
than a 30-year loan
right.
on your
and
house.
And so therefore, you can when you're churning those more quickly, you're probably paying more in your monthly or annual payments. But at the end, you can, you know, when that debt's paid off, you can then borrow more and keep your debt level the same.
And you pay shorter terms,
right.
you pay absolutely less.
Right. And that's why I tried to be balanced in this and show that the city is being proactive. About 3 years ago, they put in new policies on their debt that had never existed before. Like you said, there's that. They imposed a lower cap than the state requires in terms of their total tax-supported debt load. So, you know, they've been trying to be proactive, but the numbers are still growing. They're still borrowing a lot more. And it seems like every time that there needs to be something done, they say, oh, we'll just bond it. So just for the public to know.
Chris, do you hear discussions about this at City Hall?
You know, there's some concern. And, you know, what James was talking about, I was reminded of something that the city manager had said years ago. So when the 13 election happened, you know, it was mostly about the streetcar and the parking plan, right? And I recall over and over again people saying, well, we can't afford this streetcar. You know, this is just too much money. And one of the things that the mayor and many members of council and the manager wanted to do several years ago was really accelerate the rate at which the streets were paved and which vehicles were replaced for both the fire department and the police department. And they went out and they borrowed the money to do all of that. And it was, I don't know, it was in the neighborhood of $90 million, wasn't it, James?
It was about $95. The total program was $100 million. So, and they borrowed 75% of that so far.
So they borrowed, they're going to borrow all of that money to do that. And so it was just striking to me that, oh, we can't afford the streetcar project, but then, you know, when we asked the city manager about this, we said, well, how do you afford to do all of this? And he said, the city's fiscal management was and is extremely conservative, and we have room to add this debt to the books.
Right.
And I don't have an objective financial analysis of that statement, but that's what I recall him saying at the time. So I think there is concern, but there is an attitude that it's not too bad, and we can afford what we're doing.
And in the city's defense, when it comes to that program, a lot of that stuff had been deferred because of the recession.
Right.
The city was in terrible financial shape. They were patching the budget with these bluebirds that they get. They were running deficits. They couldn't afford to fix the streets or the street or the other vehicles. And newer vehicles are more efficient than fixing old ones, right? They're more fuel efficient. They're going to last longer or whatever. That being said, Chris is right. There is the attitude, oh, if something comes up, we can just borrow for it. And that has some people concerned. I talked to Smitherman about it, and he's a financial analyst, and he's like, we don't want to go too far with this.
Yeah.
Some of us are old enough to remember the Smale Commission, which actually tried to lay out a plan for repairing the streets, buying capital goods like fleets and buildings and whatever. And somehow we've sort of forgotten what the Smale Commission told us. You know, Antoinette, one of the things that is part of all of this is the Western Hills Viaduct. Mm-hmm. And you don't have to be a genius if you drive across the Western Hills Viaduct, especially if you drive across the lower level of the Western Hills Viaduct. If you're on the top level, you may not see much. But if you're driving across the lower level of the Western Hills Viaduct off of Spring Grove, that thing needs to be replaced. I mean, there isn't any question about it. So, I mean, it's one of these giant infrastructure issues that we got to face.
And it's definitely. I'm sorry, Angela, go ahead.
Definitely. And periodically we get photographs sent to the newsroom. Look, there's a crack. I'm afraid to drive over this, and then we check into it and we get the answer that everything's fine. Well, everything's not fine. I mean, maybe the thing's not going to fall down, but it needs to be replaced. And how are we going to do that?
Well, the region faces a lot of those decisions because you lump the Brent Spence Bridge into that. And now we're talking billions and billions. And just to put it into perspective, and I know I didn't give this figure, the city owes $1.25 billion with a B dollars. That's, you know, $1.25 billion. That's a lot of money. Now, half of it is for things like MSD and waterworks and things that are supported by fees. But those fees are going up to pay for the debt. Stormwater fees are probably going to go up because they shifted stuff over from the regular budget, and now stormwater's paying for it, and stormwater's backed up on their maintenance, so they need to borrow more money. So,
yeah, all of that sort of fits together. And in one sense, this isn't just a Cincinnati issue.
No,
this is a national issue, and it ultimately could play into the national conversation about infrastructure. I want to shift one more time here and like to play a bit of sound that we have from Jeff Birding when he was on this program on Wednesday. So let's listen to Jeff.
As we are acquiring commercial properties adjacent to Stargell Stadium, we have to start paying people a lot of money. And if obviously we're willing to run the risk, we don't control all the properties that we need on the site, and we still have to go to Cincinnati City Council. But if we can't even get the CPS piece done, which we thought, given that our genuine interest in being strong partners with CPS, if we can't even get this piece done, then it's probably a real waste of a lot of money. Again, we're going to start spending upwards of $1 million on real estate.
That was on Wednesday. And that was the day that FC Cincinnati issued a deadline in the morning. They had to have an answer by 5 o'clock that afternoon. Anjanette, what's your understanding of where we really stand right now?
Well, it's my understanding that it's not a completely – that the deal is not dead. I heard Eve Bolton –
The deal with the Cincinnati Public Schools.
Correct. That they're not necessarily slamming the door on it, but they just – I heard Eve Bolton say yesterday they can't set a precedent by accepting such a small amount of money for the property taxes. To me, it seems that this is a little bit of hardball, going to CPS and saying, here's our 5 o'clock deadline. That seems a little harsh to me when you're the one who wants the property and there is opposition to it. So it's very odd. I think CPS would probably be open to more of a real negotiation than just the hardball tactics that were given. That
one
were
of the
being
things that was interesting, if I'm understanding this right, is first off, the Board of Education fears that if they give too much of a deal to FC Cincinnati and then they have to go to the voters for a levy, mm-hmm. voters are going to say, well, why'd you give those rich people such a good deal? And now you're coming to us. So the other side of this is that I think the Board of Education – and people I talked to at the Board of Education said they felt this 5 o'clock deadline was an artificial deadline, and they were going to continue to follow their procedures. And they issued a statement yesterday, which indicates to me that in their minds, they're still moving forward on their schedule, which is to take a vote next Wednesday, so it's not closed.
Look, there is no way that the Board of Education could have capitulated is the word to that deadline. These are some of them are aspiring politicians. Some of them only really care about education, but they're also, you know, not only their own political futures, but what you just said about their future levies. And I think there's such a divide in this community sometimes between the city and the suburbs. I think suburban folks were looking at this and like, well, that's a pretty good deal. They're getting $750,000 they're not going to get now. But there's a growing discussion in this community about the abatement of property taxes. And I hear it more and more, and it's a surprising thing to me because it's such an esoteric government issue. But there is a kind of a growing, you know, discussion of, well, everyone should pay their property taxes. And that's not just the FC Cincinnati people, but it's also, you know, people who build new homes in the city. The city is growing again, and slowly but surely, and you know, a lot of people build new houses or they tear down existing houses, and their property taxes are abated for 12, 10, 15 years. And there are people in this city that are increasingly not liking that.
Now, James, when taxes are abated on development like that, mm-hmm. there is this idea that schools are held harmless. And
that doesn't always happen. A lot of times they actually have to go to get a separate agreement with the Board of Education in that particular jurisdiction, whether it be CPS or some of the other local school districts. And, you know, it happens all the time in Kentucky as well, where I'm from. So what's interesting about this whole thing, whether it be with the city, the county, or whatever, is – and I tried to dive in last fall during the last set of deadlines into just how much money does the Major League Soccer make? How much money does a soccer franchise make? And nobody wants to talk about it. They all keep it behind their own little shield. It's so opaque, and yet they're asking us as taxpayers for money, and they won't say, here's how much money we're going to make. Here's our profitability or losses over the next, you know, 5-10 years. So there's this trust us factor. And, you know, it's kind of hard for a lot of people to swallow that coming from Jeff Birding, who also pitched the stadium deal for the Bengals.
And let's face it, that is a backdrop to this whole
discussion. Absolutely. Absolutely. So, but getting back to your original question, yeah, the whole idea of abatements and property taxes, it doesn't always hold the schools harmless. So schools definitely are impacted by it.
Now, there have been from the beginning of this whole discussion about a stadium for FC is that three different sites have been in play. First, the focus was on Oakley and a lot of negotiations about getting the city in line with that. Then the sort of pivoted to the West End. And then Newport sort of hanging out over here, which we don't hear much about. I can't get clear, you know, whether it's a player or not. Where do you think they want to be?
They want to be in Cincinnati. They want to be in Cincinnati proper, and I know that from sources, that the management and the ownership of the team says Cincinnati on the jersey. They want to be in Cincinnati.
Agree.
Newport is just being held out as a leveraging stick. I would be shocked if the team wound up in Newport. I do not think management wants it in Newport, but they're using them as just like, oh, we'll go there if you don't agree to us. And quite frankly, as a Kentucky resident, it kind of irritates me to see this happening. But, I mean, Kentucky and Newport have to play the game.
Let me tell you something. The decision makers in the city, they know that. They're not afraid of it going to Newport. In fact, I think many of them would be like, fine, go ahead. You know, some people are finally thinking regionally. And think about Pittsburgh, for example, the layout of Pittsburgh. There's a river that runs right through the city. It's a similar layout to us. It just doesn't have another state there.
Yeah, and the stadium is out across that river.
It's across
both
the river.
Both of them are,
It doesn't matter. It's all one region.
Well, I think that we need to point out, too, there's an important point to make here. The whole Newport thing is it's ridiculous because, as you said, it says Cincinnati on the jerseys and they want it in Cincinnati. But also, Jeff Birding has been saying he's been hearing from people in Newport. He's been talking to people in Newport. I know one of our reporters just this week talked to the people in Newport and, you know, the players, and they have not talked to Jeff Birding. So I would
when
like
say,
I don't
when
I,
you say the players, you mean the political players.
Yes. And I don't know. That's my understanding from the reporting that our station has done. Maybe they're talking to the baker down the street. I have no idea who they're talking to, but it's our understanding they are not discussions.
There's been some conversations, at least maybe not directly with the team, but within the economic development community over there.
Mm-hmm. Triad.
Yeah, and others. But to kind of put together some state deal because they would need to improve the roads in and out of there. But that Ovation site is already pretty much dig ready. It's not like they need to build anything like these other places, tear down or whatever. It's just a big empty field right there that they, you know, so it isn't like they have to put together this big, you know, infrastructure package or whatever. So
I get asked all the time, like, what do you think's really going on here? And this has gone on so long, and there's been so many machinations. And I tell people, I am staring into a funhouse mirror, and I don't know what's real and what is not, you know?
Okay, but let me ask this. Let's just say for a moment that the club really wants something on the Ohio side.
Mm-hmm.
Which of the two sites, Oakley versus West End, do you think they really want?
West End.
Yeah.
No question.
I think I don't think Oakley's doable. I mean, sure, it's doable. But think about that. Think it's a mess over there anyway right now, traffic-wise. It just wouldn't be that great of a site. At least you could do something and build off of the West End site.
Well, West End right next to over the Rhine, right near the park. I mean, you can walk to it from this building. I mean, it's walkable from – you could walk to it pretty easily from the Red Stadium if you wanted to. It's only about a mile walk. It, you know, there's already bars starting up over in this side of town. I agree with the
So it's
the
a way of keeping that urban feel.
Which is what MLS has stated in their bids. They want to be part of an urban core. That is part of their bid package.
So that's their business model too. I mean, that they think younger people, that's where soccer's growing. Urban core is where they are. And that's where we need to be. That's where our customer needs to be. You know, I still think that the West End could happen. Aside from last week's events.
It's going to be interesting though to see if they can sort of walk back from what happened last week or this week and get back into real negotiations and see if there's something going on behind the scenes and to come up with a number.
Yeah,
for that tax money.
What you just said is important. You know, that's the core question. What is the number on the property taxes that the school district, or that four of the seven school board members, will accept and be and feel that they will be able to sell to the community that we didn't give away the store, we got a good deal, let's go forward.
You know, one of the things I noticed, though, in an earlier proposal that they had was it wasn't just property tax. It was, some of the money was going to be calculated based upon how good their profits were running,
which is completely the wrong way to go about it. I know that
that is
Jeff
really
Burning
dangerous.
Doesn't like to hear that. You know what they ought to what they should have done is gone and look. Okay, how do other states and cities value stadiums? Because somebody made the point, I think it's a valid one. You know, stadium might be like a little bit of a car, right? You take it off the lot, it immediately starts to devalue. Just because you put $250 million into the stadium does not mean that is the value of the stadium when it's all said and done. They would probably be, you know, smart to go across the country and take a look at that issue and see if they can tell the school board the stadium is going to really be worth X number of dollars when it's built. Let's pay our taxes and or let's make our payments in lieu of taxes based on that number.
Let me ask this question. We've focused sort of on the City Hall situation. We've focused on FC. We've talked about the debt. Are there issues this week, stories that you've been working on that are important and haven't gotten the attention maybe that they deserve?
March Madness. No, I'm just kidding.
March Madness.
James's bracket, right?
Yeah, exactly. Go UK.
Is that soccer? No, I do. No. Yeah, well, March Madness is great.
My answer is no on that one.
No on that one. Okay. How about you, Anjanette? Anything you've been – have you been working on these stories? This is what you've been doing.
Well, I've been doing the mayor and the city manager war all week long. I was you know, I was taken – I started on other stories and then was taken off of those. I get the text or the call.
Right.
By the way, we need to switch you over to the mayor and city manager. Okay. So that's essentially what I've been kind of immersed in all week.
People who haven't worked in newsrooms maybe not appreciate that. Yeah. You start down one path and it's all of a sudden the assignment editor calls and says, guess what? Yeah. You're now going over here.
You think you're almost done and guess what? No, start over.
So, well, I want to thank all three of you for being here and helping us sort of get some context, some understanding of what's been going on this week in some controversial areas. And I want to thank my guests, Chris Wetterich of the Cincinnati Business Courier, Anjanette Levy of Local 12 News, and James Pilcher of the Cincinnati Enquirer. When I return, I'll be joined by 91.7 WVXU's Tana Weingartner to update us on the status of the recovery from a pipeline rupture in Coleraine Township 4 years ago. This is 91.7 WVXU's Cincinnati Edition. I'm Dan Hurley. In March 2014, an oil pipeline broke in Oak Glen, a property in Coleraine Township owned and managed by the Great Parks of Hamilton County. From the beginning, WVXU's reporter Tana Weingartner has been following the cleanup and restoration of the site. Over the last 4 years, she has filed many stories that can be heard on our website in the archives. As we come up on the fourth anniversary of the spill, she has an updated story. And Tana joins me now in the studio. Tana, welcome
Thanks.
To Cincinnati Edition. And this is a story that clearly has some real personal appeal to you. I mean, you stuck with this for a long time.
Yeah, in fact, I reached out to the spokesperson for Sunoco Logistics, who was kind of in charge of the pipeline talk. And he, in the most kindest way possible, wrote back to my email and sort of said, wow, I can't believe you're still covering this.
Doggedness. That's what reporters are about. Well, you have prepared a new report, and
yes.
I'd like to have us listen to that report right now.
There's been a big change here because this used to be a containment dam that was built to contain oil that came from the pipeline spill in 2014.
Brett Henninger gazes down on a gully with a stream that gives way to a swampy pond. He's the chief of conservation and parks with Great Parks of Hamilton County. The creek bed looks man-made. Large slabs of stone make it feel like a child's nature playscape. Dirt covers the banks rather than forest, but still, it's progress.
The site's starting to heal now. There's no dozers, there's no equipment in sight, so it's kind of nice to see the nature preserve begin to start to heal.
Restoration began about a year and a half ago. Before that, contractors for Sunoco Logistics removed roughly 19,000 gallons of oil. The company estimates 20,000 spilled from the broken pipeline. It settled with the Park District in 2016, agreeing to fund the cleanup and pay out $923,000. Oil remains at the site. Getting every last drop would have meant tearing out the forest, doing more damage than the spill itself. The goal now is to get the preserve back to a semblance of what it was. Hundreds of saplings replace gravel roads constructed during cleanup. Herbicides are weeding out invasive plants tracked in by workers that are overwhelming native species. Scientists monitor the creek for signs of life like insects and cave salamanders, an endangered species in Ohio and a key environmental indicator. You won't find them if the water quality is poor. Great Parks is also waiting to see if the rare lark sparrow will return to the preserve's prairie land. Great Parks Director of Marketing and Public Engagement, Jennifer Sivak, remembers vividly the awful moment when she first heard about the spill. Gazing across the preserve 4 years later, she's conflicted.
Right now, I think it looks like a different preserve than what it was. But as you come up the stream and go up even closer to the break, it starts to feel like the nature preserve that we know and love.
Brett Henninger says protecting places like Oak Glen is important because it's a part of Ohio's history. These natural resources, he says, defined the region for hundreds of years.
I think it's preserving an extraordinary place. We want people to be able to visit places that they can imagine themselves in that place 200 or 300 years ago. And this is one of those places where when you get deep into the woods up on the hill, you kind of forget you're in a metropolitan area of, you know, a county of 800,000 people. So it's a pretty neat place.
Oak Glen remains closed to the public. Restoration should wrap up this summer. After that, the preserve will reopen once U.S. Fish and Wildlife, the Ohio EPA, and Great Parks are convinced the plants and wildlife are stable and humans won't affect their return.
Well, great report.
Thank you.
Given what you see there, what do you – would you say this has been a successful restoration? This has been a successful cleanup and, secondly, restoration?
I mean, I'm not a scientist by any stretch, but yes, from looking at what it was, I was there in the days after the spill, the weeks after the spill, and what it looks like today. Yeah, they've got – tons of oil out of there. It's 20,000 gallons, almost 19,000 gallons out of there. You know, you used to be able, even 2 years ago when I was there, you could still smell oil. When I went back there a couple weeks ago, you couldn't smell it anymore. The water is looking clean there. We did find a few bugs. They're looking for those cave salamanders. So yeah, I mean, and Great Park seems very pleased. Ohio EPA seem pleased so far.
So one of the things that struck me, you were mentioning the cave salamanders, mm-hmm. but also this lark sparrow.
Yes.
What strikes me as interesting is that this is a large enough area. It's not just the stream. Mm-hmm. A species like that would somehow stay away, disappear.
Well, they lost their prairie land. So this is what's kind of interesting to me about the way Oak Glen is. You know, it's forest. It starts flat down when you at the entrance, quote unquote. Now there's never been a parking lot or anything there. You know, it's pretty much untouched completely. No trails, nothing. But it goes up this big hill to where the break site was. So you've got forest up on the hill, and you've got this stream, and you've got the pond. But at the bottom, there used to be this open prairie. Now, the lark sparrow wants a really, like, desolate landscape. You know, it wants kind of basically a sandy area with a few sprigs of grass. It's very particular. And that's what used to be there. But this big prairie became a staging area when they had to bring in all of the vehicles to get to the oil and stuff. And so when I was there 2 years ago, there were trees, there were weeds the size of trees growing on what used to be this, you know, prairie. And so the larch sparrows haven't been seen since. Now, they're hopeful because they've seen them on adjacent properties, and they knew that they were at Oak Glen before. So they are hopeful that maybe they'll start to take an interest.
Come back.
Yeah.
Use us again. the whole reference to invasive plant species.
Yes.
You know, for people who aren't into nature and restoration and don't go to the parks on it.
Yeah.
Why is that? Why does that seem such a terrible thing? Because apparently from earlier reports, a lot of those entered this site because they were tracked in on the boots of workers who were there to try to do the cleanup.
Right, the boots and the equipment and the equipment. Trucks and everything that had to come. So a lot of people know the most famous of invasive species, the honeysuckle. And I think most people kind of understand why it, you know, it just kind of grows and grows and grows. And they understand that it chokes out everything else. It's the same with these invasive ground covers that are in Oak Glen at the moment. They're choking out all of the native plants that you would want to have there or that should be there. And since there's nothing, you know, there's nothing eating them, there's nothing to stop their spread, they're just taking over. So what should be, you know, maybe a sparse ground, what you would see if you went into a forest, you know, is gone because it's just covered in this like Japanese stilt grass, these green plants, and you think, oh, that's good, but it's bad because they don't belong there.
Okay. Maybe on a largest question in terms of what I was left with listening to your various reports was, what's sort of the lesson about a break, a spill like this? Now, this was relatively relatively contained. But what's the larger lesson we ought to learn here?
Well, this pipeline was pretty old at the time, and it was, you know, I did put that question to Sunoco, what have you learned? And they didn't necessarily answer that in their response to me. But what I would think maybe they've learned is they're checking the pipelines more. They use a special tool that they can kind of send down it. I forget what it's called, but I think it has pig in the name or hog or something, to check the line more frequently. They also believe that the rupture happened because the pipeline was sitting on shale or slate and it was rubbing. So I think they've learned that maybe that's not the best way to, you know, bury pipelines now.
But, of course, that's exactly what we have around here.
Well, yeah.
A lot of that. So, well, thank you very much for this report. Thanks for joining us today.
You're very welcome.
And thanks for sticking with this story. And I hope that a year from now we get another report. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. The producer for today's show is Pete Reitmeier. The assistant producer is Selena Reeder. And the technical director, Josh Elstro. We had some extra help from Kevin Reynolds. Archives for our programs are available on the website wvxu.org. I'm Dan Hurley.